The plans of the floors of the building showed that it was a perfect place for royal entertainment and parties. But it was decided that they return into the residence of the king and Farah by making a few changes. For 11 years, this palace, which was built over the ruins of the lives of a huge destitute nation, had been their residence. It was in the same palace that Mohammad Reza Pahlavi ruled over the country by using the power of the court, Savak, his obedient militants, and his full-fledged dictatorship. Once in a while, he participated in the meetings of the militants and gave a speech about the importance and role of the army. In this way, he commended them and awarded them different medals. He did similar things with other people, for example, his agents and servants, and anyone who flattered him. The number of these medals had increased to so many that even after 30 years we can still see some of them in antique shops. The row of courtiers, relatives and acquaintances waiting for the gold and rewards from the king was so long on some days that, as Azadullah Azam, the minister of the court, says, giving out so many coins was getting boring and tiring for the king himself. The king thought that with such generosities, he would be able to buy a protecting and impenetrable group of people for himself and his monarchy. As the crisis increased, the king realized in hearing the first cries of the people that his group of people were deserting him by escaping from the country even sooner than himself. Didn't he really know the only protectors of governors are their people? He and his father had taken office with the help of foreigners, so they didn't consider any particular law for the people. Reza Khan staged his first coup with a team of the militants under the supervision of the English people on February the 22nd, 1920, and apparently didn't need the people in order to continue his reign. The next coup, which had a fundamental role in authorizing the Pahlavi dynasty, took place in September 1941. This coup happened in Iran while it was occupied, and during this coup, a father left office abjectly and was exiled, and a son took office very disgracefully while he was indebted to the foreigners. By doing so, the allies who wanted to obtain Iran without any resistance on the part of the people were given this opportunity very easily. Maybe some people don't consider the coup of September 1941 comparable to the earlier conventional coups. But everyone agrees that Mohammad Reza took office with the help of occupying foreign militants, and the real meaning of coup here is nothing but using illegitimate martial power. The next coup of the Pahlavi dynasty was the shameful and bloody coup of August 19, 1953, a coup which resulted in the domination of the American government over Iran. Suppressing the revolt of the Iranian Muslims on June 5, 1963, was another coup by the Pahlavi dynasty, which was launched in a new form and was even bloodier and more extensive than the coup of August 19, 1953. killing of people on this day resulted in the continuation of the Pahlavi regime until 1979. In late fall of 1978, when the objection or revolt of the Iranian people was at its climax, another coup was about to happen. This coup was proposed in Pahlavi's governing board from the early days when the demonstrations increased by the millions and there was certainty about the irreconcilability of Imam Khomeini. The ambassadors of the United States and England in Tehran constantly held meetings in the palaces to fight against the crisis. The king had put them in charge of the destiny and security of the country. Therefore, he informed them of all the events of the country and acted upon their opinions. In the king's opinion, the people were never his sanctuary. For the same reason, he had chosen the governments of the United States and England as his sanctuary. But the fact of the matter is that a person should not be dependent on a person who is dependent on yet another. In the summer of 1978, the American government was bewildered and perplexed in dealing with the Islamic Revolution in spite of its domination over the world. And the basis of this bewilderment was the endless conflict between Brzezinski, the national security advisor of Jimmy Carter's government, the American president at that time, on the one hand, and Cyrus Maynes, the foreign minister, and William Sullivan, the United States ambassador in Tehran, on the other hand. The massacre of September the 8th, which was the preparation for a coup, had no results. So the Americans decided to realize this plan by installing the Marshall government of Azhari. Marshall Azhari was a military man, astonishing like the heroes in American action movies. After the defeat of Azhari's Marshall government, the plan of a coup was seriously thought of. The marshals and lieutenant generals of the king's regime were too bewildered and frustrated to have a definite, consistent, and defendable plan for the coup. The power of the revolution had foiled all their plots. On the one hand, they were concerned with their personal status and their property, as well as their dark background, and on the other hand, the instability of the personality of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, whose best solution in that situation was escaping the scene. With their simplistic calculations and narrow-mindedness, they couldn't even compare what was happening in the streets of Tehran with the events of 1951 to 1953 and realize that the ocean of people in the Islamic Revolution was stormier in comparison to the narrow still river of the nationalizing oil industry movement. The little hope that the United States and the king had were pinned on Bakhtiar's government, which had made them hesitant and dubious in staging the coup they had planned. The senior commanders of the king's army thought that whenever the army was able to massacre the people and become victorious, the army wouldn't obey Mohammad Reza either, let alone such a detested person like Bakhtiar. But the most important problem was that the main body of the army, which consisted of officers, petty officers, and conscripts, didn't want to enter such a horrible battle. In such circumstances, the high-ranking officers of the king's army were more willing to seek solutions from the commanders of the American army. And therefore, the presence of American people in handling the situation was necessary. In August 1953, the Americans had sent a very mean person like Grimith Roosevelt to supervise the operations of the coup. He was more similar to a Rhodesian henchman than an official militant. In August 1953, Grimith Roosevelt called a number of the least important figures in the army, such as Brigadier General Fazlullah Zahedi and paid some money to the villains and therefore succeeded in his mission. But the situation had changed. In the fall of 1978, the United States knew that the task was not as easy as in 1953. In such circumstances, they sent another person to Tehran to plan and launch the coup. He was a four-starred general, Robert Heiser. General Heiser was one of the 184 four-star generals of the United States Air Force. His participation in the Second World War and his important positions of commanding the bombing operations of the Air Force in the Far East and in the war between Korea and Vietnam promoted him to the commander of the American forces in Europe. According to American reports, Heiser was dispatched to Iran on January 1979 to try to stabilize Iran. He knew some of the high-ranking figures of Iran's army very well. In his book called A Mission in Tehran, Heiser calls his trip to Tehran a mission which started with disappointment and ended in disaster. In 1986, he called his mission in Tehran a strange experience. He said that he knew very well that he couldn't retain Mohammad Reza Pahlavi in power. Many supporters of the king in the United States blame the General Heiser for the downfall of the Pahlavi government. The coup that General Heiser wanted to launch was like a blunt knife trying to cut the strong waves of the Islamic Revolution. Now, 30 years after those events, we can learn many important things. Heiser was in Tehran for 1 month and 2 days. He left Tehran on February 6, 1979, 5 days before the final victory of the Islamic Revolution. On that day, the spokesman of the White House, despite their frequent support of Bakhtiar's government, said that Bakhtiar had to accept the opinion of the majority of the people. This acceptance marked the end of the hopes of the United States in Bakhtiar's government and the king's regime. Marshal Fardous claims in his memory book that General Heiser had traveled to Iran to take Americans out from Iran, especially military advisors, as well as removing particular technical parts which were installed on F-14 airplanes and American radars which were installed on the border of Iran and the Soviet Union. However, Marshal Qareboghi, the last chairman of the Joint Staff of the King's Army, says that Heiser sometimes talked about a coup. In his book, General Heiser denies his mission as launching a coup against Imam Khomeini, the people, and the Islamic Revolution. But the official website of the Air Force of the United States says that General Heiser was blamed for failing in his mission. But if his only mission was to take the Americans out, he was apparently very successful in that mission. But later it became evident that General Heiser's most important responsibility was the unconditional help of the American militants in launching a bloody coup. But he had to escape Iran empty-handed. In the climax of his popularity and military success, General Heiser admitted a heavy defeat on the part of the Iranian People's Revolution. At the end of his life, he was buried in a far-off graveyard, and his epitaph describes his position briefly. On February 11, 1979, the American government announced officially that it accepted the Islamic Revolution. But for 30 years after the revolution, it plotted against Iran day after day and never gave up. The Nojeh coup, 3 months before the imposed war of Saddam against Iran, which was discovered and neutralized, was part of the same efforts started by Heiser in 1979. The Americans, who were experts in designing and performing different kinds of coups, were powerless and helpless against the knowledgeable and resistant people of Iran. After the Islamic Revolution, and with the deep and memorable teachings of Imam Khomeini, the time for a coup had finished forever in Iran. Thus, the fundamental and vital element of the people was born in the politics of Iran for the first time. With his permanent emphasis on the people, and with his proper behavior towards them, Imam Khomeini announced the people as the owner of the country, revolution, and the government forever. 18 years of government by the supreme leader Ayatollah Khamenei turned this tree into a rooted, huge, and fruitful one. And now, nothing will happen in this country without the permission of its owners.